Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome to another one of our Urbanite radio stories. In this month's Urbanite, there was an article that was called Med School Redux. Bioscience breakthroughs transform the way we look at human health, schools race to train a new generation of doctors, which really had to do with J.M. Giordano and Ron Casey, and really had to do with how our study of the human genome is transforming the world of medicine. And so we're bringing two people here in our studios today to talk about that idea and about the human genome. We have with us in the studio Dr. Alan Schuldiner, who is director of the University of Maryland School of Medicine's program in genomics and personalized medicine, and Dr. Brian Masters, who's a professor in the Department of Biology at Towson University. And Brian and Alan, welcome. Good to have you both with us.
Good to be here. Thank you.
Thank you.
Let's just take a step back for a minute before we jump into any of the meat of the world today. The 19 years or so that I've been doing this stuff on the air, we've covered a lot around the human genome and its development of the human genome project. So if you could just take a back, think about where we've come in the last 20, 30 years, when we really started really thinking about mapping out the human genome and where this has come to. Alan, we can start with you.
Sure. Well, you know, it's barely 50 years since the structure of DNA itself has been known. And, of course, all of genetic material is based upon DNA. So, really, we can date genetics, at least the modern era of genetics, down to about 50 years ago. And now we have just amazing granularity of our understanding of genomes, the human genome in particular, right down to the 3 billion chemical building blocks that make up each of us.
3 billion, you said.
That's correct. So we have about 3 billion building blocks in the human genome, and of the billions of people on this planet, you know, we're mostly the same. Most of us have two eyes and a nose and a couple of arms, 10 fingers, et cetera. But there's only about less than 1% actually that differs among all of us that make each of us unique. And now at a very granular level, we're beginning to learn how these differences matter with regard to health and disease.
And they can be significant. The 1% can be a significant number even though it's a small number.
That's right. So there are probably 5 or so million differences in chemical building blocks on average that differ among different people. And that's what makes all the difference between determining who's going to develop a disease and who's not. And how we're going to respond to medications and many things about our attributes.
Brian?
Yeah, from a personal perspective, I mean, I started out, you know, in my professional career, you know, sequencing DNA. And so I was, back in the 80s, I was in a state-of-the-art lab sequencing a gene and that we had isolated, and I sequenced that gene. It took me about a year, and it was about 5,500 of these chemical building blocks that Alan is talking about. So that took me a year to do 5,000 of these things. And now, of course, when I tell my students about that, they always laugh because the technology has just leapt ahead of itself so much that it's almost like you think about computers and they have this idea of Moore's Law, the idea that there's this logarithmic expansion of the speed of computers and in the memory of computers. Well, the same thing's happening in DNA sequencing. So now, you know, you can do thousands and thousands and thousands of bases on a relatively simple machine in an afternoon. And it continues to expand. And the cost of sequencing DNA is going down, and we don't know where it's going to bottom out. I mean, we joke about that, my students and I, like someday it'll cost a nickel to get your genome sequenced. I mean, you know, no one thinks that's really true, but people think in 10 years it could be $100. And so, you know, I mean, the thing that's truly amazing about it is that technology has just continues to, you know, we don't know where the bottom is, you know, or the top is, however you want to look at that. Like, you know, like it just continues to go faster and faster. And it's just amazing what we can do now. I mean, you know, I mean, things that I would have thought 10 years ago, 20 years ago, I would have thought never could have been done are being done. I mean, they just recently published the Neanderthal genome.
Right. I read about that.
I mean, so,
right.
I mean, there they are. I mean, they're, you know, that's, I mean, who would have thought? So it's just an amazing thing.
Well, so what is that? What do you think that, what do you both think that means? What would it mean that if we could, that everybody could access or have accessed their genome, their entire, what would that, how would that, what would that do to medical science, what would it do for us? What would it mean?
Well, I think it certainly will and already is transforming the way we think about human disease. For one thing, it's going to redefine all disease. We call diseases now based upon what we think we know about them and how patients present in a clinical setting, doctor's office or hospital. But knowing exactly the molecular etiologies of various diseases is going to allow us basically to redefine all of medicine. We're going to have new diseases, and we're going to be having to rename all the diseases we think we know something about now. So that's, for one thing, will really change the way we think about disease. But then on the other side, of course, it will open up all sorts of opportunities for new and novel treatments for these diseases once we understand the underlying molecular basis. And this is what we are beginning to call personalized medicine, the idea that based upon one's genome, one's individual genome, it'll be possible to better define not only the disease but also how to treat it best.
So that literally we're talking about that if you had your – if you had a map of our individual human genome, each one of us, that medicine could then begin to pinpoint why – how you might react to certain medicines, why this is – why you're – let's say for want of a better term, let's say you had irritable bowel syndrome, which they know so little about. That might be able to map out what it is that's really going on, and you can figure out how to treat that patient in a way that you could never imagine to do it at this moment.
Right. Or one therapy might work for one person and not for another. And, you know, it's just like all these things that are happening. There's stuff with selenium and cancer, for instance. And, you know, it turns out that we already know from the genetic data we already have that there are some people who respond differently to that selenium intake versus others. And so, you know, your response to that selenium intake and your risk for cancer is going to be different depending on your genetic background. And I'm sure there are lots of things like that. I mean, they just recently in the news, they were talking about Avastin, you know, the anti-cancer drug for breast cancer.
Right.
And, you know, now they're not recommending that. And it's because for some people it doesn't seem to work. For some people it does work. And you know, if I had to guess, there's probably a genetic basis to that. I mean, I don't know. You know, they haven't worked that out yet. But I'm saying it wouldn't surprise me if that was the case. And so, you know, the reason why we get these things all the time happening is that, you know, the therapy works for some people but not for others. And there could be that that's a genetic basis and could be other things as well. But, I mean, you know, that at least once we have the genetic information on people, we'll know if that's the case, right? I mean, and also for risks. I mean, you know, the risk for cancer is not evenly distributed. I mean, so when you look at breast cancer risk, I mean, there was a paper I read where they said approximately 90% of the risk is in the top half of the population. In other words, if you look at risk. So what's going to happen is if you have a genotype, they very well may know, you know, you have very low risk for this type of cancer or very high risk for this type of cancer. I mean, there'll be all kinds of things that are coming out, you know, from this type of information. So, I mean, you know, I think it changes everything. It's a game changer in a very big way, even for people who aren't being treated for a disease at that time. I mean, just how they see themselves, maybe.
Mm-hmm. Alan?
Yeah. So the area that Brian is introducing is an area that's probably the forefront of personalized medicine. It's called pharmacogenomics. And just as Brian said, based upon an individual genome, now in many cases we can predict in advance whether a given medication is going to work for that patient or not. And maybe more importantly, we can predict based on genetics whether a given individual is going to have a severe adverse reaction or even death because of a medication. And, of course, knowing that based on genetic information in advance, you can prevent that severe adverse reaction and or choose an alternative medicine that you know will not cause the adverse reaction and will work better. One good example actually is our studies that we were involved with involving Plavix, which is a very commonly used medication for people with heart problems. And ever since it was released, it was well known that there was great variation between individuals, some people who responded really well to Plavix and others who hardly responded at all. And in fact, if you look at the literature, about a third of people don't respond at all. Yet for years, everybody got Plavix to prevent their heart attacks. And just recently, over the last few years, actually just within the last 2 years, our group as well as a few others have discovered a variation in a gene called CYP2C19, and a third of the population has that variation, and those individuals can be predicted to be non-responsive to Plavix. And now there's a new medication out, actually, that third of individuals would be more efficacious for. So that's one example now of many in the era of pharmacogenomics where we're taking genetic information and using it to individualize therapy.
So I'm curious what you both would think are the negative aspects of this. I mean, it's wonderful to be able to think about how this can transform medicine in terms of really pinpointing what medication could really help us to kind of figure out what diseases we may be truly susceptible for and have to have a dozen MRIs to do it, but know our human genome and then kind of figure out what we can, physicians and people in medicine can look for in terms of what we might contract or not contract. But what are the negative aspects of this? I mean, I can think of a number of things that might be dangerous. Everything from insurance companies refusing to underwrite and pay for somebody's health insurance because you have your human genome tells us you're susceptible for breast cancer, so we're not going to cover you. I mean, to any number of ways of cutting people out of certain things. What do you think would be things we have to watch out for here?
Well, you already. Well, the one that I always talk about with my students, and that is one of the ones you just mentioned, is, you know, with the current structure, as I understand it, the way insurance is being, I mean, someone could get their genome sequenced and then they're totally screwed at that point. I mean, they cannot get, you know, insurance. I mean, you know, and I guess that I don't know exactly how that would all work, but I mean, I could see there's real problems with that. You know, I don't really know all the issues. It's very funny because, I mean, I think the technology is sort of move so fast that, you know, I had this friend years ago that was getting her PhD in anthropology at Hopkins, and her whole thesis was on the human genome and what will happen when people have their individual genome sequenced. And I was sort of dubious about her thesis because I said, it's going to cost $3 billion to sequence this one genome. No one's going to have an individual genome sequenced. But, you know, and it turns out that she was prescient, you know, in the way she was, you know, she was anticipating this, you know, that, you know, or by luck or, you know, insight. But now, you know, that's not so far away. And so she's still doing research on this sort of stuff, you know, the effect of this kind of information on sort of our sort of view of ourselves and in the way we think about things. And so I don't know, you know, how I don't know if we can really anticipate what will happen, but, you know, what we will know. I mean, I think that sort of, it's changed the way we do things. And so, you know, once you have your own individual genome sequenced, there could be good things about it. As Alan was referring to, you know, there's not that much difference between all the humans on the planet. So maybe, you know, we'll feel more a kindred spirit for each other. But, you know, maybe
that'd be nice.
That would be. But, I mean, on the other hand, maybe, you know, I mean, you know, I could see where there could be all kinds of issues, like, you know, the idea that, you know, there's already this thing. Like, if you find out that you have this increased risk for a disease, what's that going to do to you psychologically? I mean, you know, at the age of 12 or whenever they release it. I mean, maybe we decide we won't tell people till they're 18. I mean, I don't know. I mean, you know, there are all kinds of issues, right?
Right.
But I don't know what they all are.
Alan, how would you...
Yeah, I think in addition to the ones that were mentioned, there are all sorts of nuances, a topic that can be discussed for a long time. But the couple that, for me, come to mind is, for one thing, genetic information is a little bit different from other laboratory tests that you get in that it has implications not only for yourself but also your whole family. And the question then is, what kind of information is yours and what kinds of information should you share with your family? What if family members don't want to know that information? So genetic information, I think, in terms of how you handle it, is quite different. And then, of course, you've got the layers of insurance companies that may not only be interested in your own genome but your family members' genomes, and kind of where does that stop and where do you draw the line? I guess one other area that is an interesting one is that for most diseases like diabetes, heart disease, cancer, et cetera, genes, or variations in genes more accurately, only provide susceptibility, an increase in susceptibility. They are not your destiny necessarily. They have to interact with environmental provocations, with age, with time, with things that we really don't understand. So there are two sides to that coin. One is that if a person knows that they have a genetic susceptibility to a disease, some individuals may kind of feel that that is sort of fatalism. That's in a fatalistic way that, well, this is my destiny. I'm destined to get obese or diabetic. There's nothing I can do about it, and so be it. And so for some people, the interpretation may be to undermine all the things that maybe they can do about, for example, their lifestyle to prevent or delay disease. In other cases, it may be enabling and actually will allow people to intervene in order to overcome or override the effects of their susceptibility genes. So I think there is a lot of psychological overlay to how one interprets their own genomes. In some ways, it could be very beneficial, and in other ways, it could be detrimental.
One of the things you just said, Anna Schuldiner, was something that I was been thinking a lot about. The other week, I was helping to run this two-day meeting on obesity put on by parts of your institution, University of Maryland Medical Systems. And Dr. Claire Fraser-Liggett, who runs the Institute for Genome Sciences, was talking a bit about environmental provocation and its effect on the human genetic structure, which is something we don't always we don't talk about a great deal. We don't hear a lot about it a great deal because it was always, as an example, you look at breast cancer. There's a lot of research in breast cancer has gone into genomic research, but a lot of people are saying it needs to have an equal amount of money put into environmental research and what could be the environmental effects on the genome that affect the growth of breast cancer. So, I mean, this, or as she put it, talked about a bit about, we don't know yet everything about all the antibiotics we eat in our food, how that may be restructuring our genome. So, I mean, that's a whole area, a new area that seems to be exploding in terms of where we could endeavor to research.
So I think that's right. In many ways, the genes that we really care about are the genes that interact with the environment to ultimately define disease or health, because while today we can't change the genes, we can certainly change the environment. And knowing about those genes that interact with the environment will provide those opportunities to pinpoint people in whom lifestyle changes or other changes would be beneficial. One part of the environment that's particularly interesting is the microbes, the bacteria that live on and within us. We have billions, trillions of bacteria that live on our skin, in our gut, and all of those microbes and bacteria have their own genomes. And so how our own genome interacts with the genomes that live on and within us is also very complex and involves that interaction between the environment, in this case, microbes that live on within us and our own genomes.
So that's what makes this whole field so fascinating, is just literally the explosive nature of where it might take us in the next 2 years, next 5 years, next 25 years.
Right. Well, I mean, carrying on that, there was an article recently where they were looking at the bacteria and even our food. So there was an article where from China where they had looked at these populations where they had eaten large amounts of rice, and it turned out that there was a small RNA molecule made by the rice genome, which ends up in the food, of course, of the people who are ingesting the rice, and it actually ends up interacting with the human genome of the people who have ingested it and causing not changes in the genome itself, but changes in the way that genome is being expressed.
What does that mean?
Well, that's the question. I mean, in other words, this idea is that, you know, it could be that there is actually communication of a sort between, you know, genomes that are, for instance, the bacteria that are living in us or on us, or the genomes of the organisms that we're eating. And that could influence, you know, so for instance, you know, and again, that may interact with that particular person's genome. You know, that person's genome may be more susceptible to the way that's being influenced than others. So, I mean, it could increase or decrease risk for disease. I mean, I don't think anybody really knows all those outcomes. I mean, we were talking about that, you know, that paper, and I said, well, that's kind of an amazing thing. I mean, to me, I was sort of, I'd like to see confirmation that this is really happening. In other words, there was an article where this is, you know, I don't know that this is real. I said, but if it is real, to me, it's a big game changer. You know, if you look at it from an evolutionary perspective, these things are going to be evolving with each other. You know, the organism is going to be producing these RNA molecules, which then influence the animal that is feeding on it. You know, like the plant, mm-hmm, and the animal, mm-hmm. And so what I'm saying is it's a complexification of the whole thing. I mean, it's like things that we weren't even thinking about before now are something that, well, do we need to worry about this? Do we need to think about these influences?
It seems to me it gives rise to – this whole field has given rise to for a long time to these new genomic determinists, for want of a better term. But this that changes the nature of that as well.
I think it does. You know, there are now a number of studies that do suggest that genes, at least the ones for the common diseases that I mentioned, are not destiny, and that you can override the effects of many of these gene variations because they have a relatively modest effect on the risk. And in many ways and many circumstances, lifestyle has a bigger role than individual genetic variations.
And what, from what this research is going, though, it seems that even your lifestyle, the way you live your life, can affect your genomic structure or what you pass on with your genes.
Well, I think so. I think there are a number of layers of that that are scientifically very interesting. One of them is how the microbes on our skin and within us certainly are affected by the environment, and then in terms of which ones are there and what they're doing, and then how they affect human health and disease. There are also examples where our environment can kind of alter actually the structure of our chromosomes in ways that alter how the genes get expressed, and that can even be passed on generation to generation.
What's an example of that?
Well, one good example is, believe it or not, the intrauterine environment. When we think about the environment, we kind of think about what's in our atmosphere and food, et cetera. But actually, environmental exposures begin in the womb. And certain intrauterine exposures can actually predestine the fetus to have a higher propensity towards, for example, obesity or diabetes, and I'm sure other diseases as well.
So, I mean, this is what's so amazing about this. It really does. I'm just as you both of you are describing this and reading the articles, preparing for this afternoon together, is that this could change the entire nature of our understanding of who we are biologically, but also change. It could also change in terms of larger recent social policy about environmental issues and how we interact with the greater world. And this is and the really complexity of the interconnectivity of it all that I think it takes it to a place we don't never really thought about until this moment, or to this historical moment anyway.
You know, one of the things also I think is that will probably come from this, and it gets back to sort of what you were just saying now, and that is that I think to some extent we went through a phase, like starting with Gregor Mendel and his pea plants, right? I mean, we kind of went through a phase of reductionism, trying to break it down to its component parts so that we could sort of understand it. But now we're getting to a point in our technology where we need to start putting those parts back together. And because it's a very, very complex interaction, not only of, you know, the 3 billion chemical building blocks of our DNA with, you know, tens of thousands of genes that they code for,
right.
They're all interacting with each other in this very complex way. So when you look at a lot of things, like I was looking at these articles and, you know, a lot of traits that we think of, there isn't a gene for height. There isn't a gene for intelligence. There are hundreds and hundreds of loci, what we call loci regions in the genome, that are affecting that. And so it's a very complex sort of interaction between many different things, you know, within the genome that are, you know, and then we find out that the genome is interacting with its environment, you know, in some ways that we maybe didn't anticipate, so that, you know, that either the diet or the bacteria that are living on us or things like that. So, I mean, I guess, you know, again, you start to look at it in a complex web of interactions. And I think that that's where we're going to have to go to really understand how these stuff all interacts. It's not this gene does this one thing, but this gene in this context of the other genes in your genome are doing this one thing. I mean, when you have a response to selenium or a response to a particular anti-cancer drug, it's probably many places in your genome that are influencing that. And so it's a complex, you know, it's a complex situation, and, you know, one that we will be, who knows, exploring for a very long time. But I mean, you know, a more and more sophisticated understanding will have to understand that sort of interactive process.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. So this is a burgeoning area that many now are calling systems biology. Mm-hmm. The fact that if you perturb just one gene or just one thing in a large system that hundreds, even thousands of other things are changing even after you change that one thing. And to have to understand all the changes that occur in these very complex networks, I think, is going to underlie the answers to a lot of what we need to know about disease and how to treat it.
I think it's an exciting area, and I also think that it's one that I hope can excite a lot of younger people to think about what to do with their lives in terms of where they could go with work in research. I mean, this is just...
It's an endless frontier as far as I can tell.
It is. It's an endless frontier.
Right.
Maybe somebody will create the Neanderthal and bring him back. Let's hope not. But it's possible.
I don't know. Maybe. I mean, you know, that's the thing. When they talk about how do you like, you know, I talk with my students about that. And, you know, the idea is how do you get something like an extinct organism? And, I mean, the way – once you have the sequence, you know, of that genome, then you could sort of try to reverse engineer. I mean, obviously with a Neanderthal, there's an ethical question that's far beyond if you wanted to bring back, let's say, a woolly mammoth or, you know, a dire wolf or something like that. But, I mean – you know, at least I wouldn't want to say it's impossible to do something like recreate the dire wolf or, you know, something like that.
That's what I'm sorry, were you going to say something?
No, I said in theory, I think it is possible. But one thing I was going to get back to with regard to the systems biology and the fact that we deal with these very complex networks is particularly for young people who are listening. This is an area where math and computer science is particularly important. So the merging of biology with computer science is probably where the field is going to go and where the best and most insightful discoveries will be made.
That's an important point to end on, and I'm looking forward to doing this in a longer way with the two of you and others. This has really been a good conversation, one of our Urbanite conversations. I want to thank Dr. Alan Schuldiner for being with us. He's director of the University of Maryland School of Medicine's program in genomics and personalized medicine. Dr. Brian Masters is professor in the Department of Biology at Towson University. Thank you both for being with us.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
For
pleasure.
The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by Urbanite Magazine's New E-Zines. You can get your weekly fix of arts and culture, food and drink, home and design, style and shopping, and green and sustainable topics. Updated information can be delivered to your inbox. Registration is available at urbanitebaltimore.com.